Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, is there a standoff between Greece, Turkey, and Cyprus in the Eastern Mediterranean? And if so, what's behind it? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In the Eastern Mediterranean, recent confrontations over the rights to drill natural gas have threatened to reignite conflict between Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus. This conflict, emerging after Cyprus's independence in 1960 and complicated by international interventions by Greece and Turkey on behalf of their ethnic populations on the island, eluded resolution in the early part of this century with the failure of the Annan Plan in 2004. Cyprus was admitted to the European Union, but the Turkish population, having declared itself independent, have largely been excluded. But renewed Turkish interest in access and exploitation of the natural gas reserves and other energy reserves around the island have brought the conflict into a new focus, with the potential for renewed conflict and new actors in the region heightened. On today's show, we will discuss the conflict in Cyprus, oil and natural gas drilling in the Eastern Mediterranean, the impact this has on Turkey, on Greece, and other regional actors, and the role of the European Union. Our guests are Nuket Sendal, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Ohio University. She is the author of Religious Leaders and Conflict Transformation. And Aristotle Zampiris, Professor of International Relations and Director of the MSc Program in Energy, Strategy, Law, and Economics at the University of Piraeus. He is also the president of the Council for Foreign Relations of Greece. He is the author of Greece, European Political Cooperation, and the Macedonian Question. Professor Sendal, I'll ask you first, could you give us a bit of a background as to the conflict in Cyprus and Turkey's interests in the conflict?
Sure, that's a great question. And of course, that's a big question. So I would like to start and give a really, really brief history of the Turkish Republic, just as a background. So the Turkish Republic was established in 1923 from the ashes of the Ottoman Empire. I will not go into the details of this establishment years. Suffice it to say that it was established as a secular state by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who was a very secular leader, and the state was based on ethnic Turkish nationalism. So we can also say that the state's strategic leaning, the new Turkish state's strategic leaning, was faced towards the West. And there was the desire to become a member of the Western community and put a distance between the imperial past and also the issues that were going on in the Middle East and also Islam. So we fast forward to 1970s, obviously, like that's a big jump. The island of Cyprus has had Turkish and Greek communities, Cypriots. But because of its location in Eastern Mediterranean and it is closeness to both Turkey and Greece, the states of Turkey and Greece have been very interested in this island, which is very strategically located. Again, like to put it very bluntly, there starts some intercommunal violence between these communities in 1960s. And of course, both countries, Turkey and Greece, follow this really closely. And we are also looking at a not so stable Greece at the time. And right after the talk of a coup in Greece and about possibly merging the entire island of Cyprus to Greece, Turkey decides to militarily intervene as a guarantor of this Turkish Cypriot community. At the time, by the way, Turkey was governed by a nationalist, leftist nationalist party, and Turkey militarily intervened in the island. And Turkey's intervention, of course, was condemned, and it was not, until today, the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus is only recognized by Turkey, and it's not recognized by other entities. So from 1974 is the invasion, 1983 is the declaration of Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. And this has been a very important issue for many Turks, regardless of party affiliation. The matter of standing with the Turkish Cypriot brothers and being there, and it's really important, the Turkish presence in the island. So it's still a very critical issue. As both someone who grew up in Turkey and a scholar who looks at the dynamics of the conflict, I cannot see any scenario where Turkey would be very flexible about leaving the island and leaving the Turkish Cypriots to their own affairs. Right now, I mean, we also talked to like Turkish Cypriot friends who might not be very happy with the level of Turkish involvement right now on the island, especially given that the Republic of Cyprus is right now an EU member and has a very different level of economic development. And we will come to that later, as I understand in this conversation. But this is a very quick snapshot of the Turkish standing in terms of the presence in Cyprus.
Professor Zampiras, what are the Greek interests in Cyprus? What is Greece's relationship with the island? And how have Greek interests had an impact on the conflict on the island?
Well, let me first begin by saying that when we're talking about the Cyprus issue or Greek-Turkish relations, as Professor Sindel actually suggested, we're talking about a long history. And I'm reminded of William Faulkner's quote that the past is never dead, is not even past. So we have decades of history, decades of events, and competing narratives, which of course is impossible to cover within our discussion. But for Greece, Cyprus, and for the Greeks, Cyprus has been absolutely central and very important since at least the 1950s. Let me say where we stand today. From a Greek perspective, the key events were the two, not one, but two invasions in 1974 that created the following situation. An internationally recognized government that is now member not only of the United Nations, but also of the European Union, and a self-declared republic that's only recognized by Turkey, which, however, is a member of NATO, which Cyprus is not, but Greece is. Welcome to complexities, okay? So you already understand that we're talking about a traumatic history, and a history going back decades, and one that is confounded by a key geographical position and institutional complexities. From a Greek perspective, 1974 is the big event, the big turning point, and it's the big trauma. Let me also say very quickly that as is the case with a lot of conflicts that have been around for decades, the international community and the parties involved roughly understand the contours of any resolution. But getting there is very difficult. Think of the Palestinian issue, the Kurdish, or what happened with Ireland. It takes usually decades to get a resolution, and sometimes you don't even get that. So it's a very complex issue, and it's a very emotive issue for Greeks to this very day. But let me just stress that we now have two other complications. I suggested that we have the institutional complication. Different countries belong to different institutions with veto power, okay? But now we also have substantial energy findings in the region, which was not the case in 1974 or in the 1950s. So that's a new development. And we also have what I would say a partial withdrawal of the United States interest in the region, which has allowed other actors to play a more prominent role, such as, for example, France. So we're entering a more complicated picture, which is not just about Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus, but it's now about the Eastern Mediterranean. So things are more dangerous, more complex, and more important at the same time.
So Nukhet, this is often described, particularly in the Western European press, as Turkey becoming much more aggressive in this region. Is it fair to say that the potential crisis within this region is being driven by Turkey's interest in kind of changing the status quo and trying to pursue a bit more of an aggressive foreign policy in the region?
So yes and no. I think everybody is aggressive right now in Eastern Mediterranean. I, for example, followed that in another case that I have always been interested in and studied, Israel. All the workshops I have been invited to within the past 5 years focused on Eastern Mediterranean. So which shows the desire to maybe leave Middle East behind and look forward and be part of a different community with different interests. And of course, these gas explorations, the hydrocarbons made these dynamics even more pronounced. So we are seeing every actor in Eastern Mediterranean now focusing more aggressively on the region because it has real implications financially, economically, for countries that could use that edge. If we are talking about Turkey, of course, Turkey has been following a very aggressive foreign policy, especially lately. That is actually very different from the foreign policy Erdogan touted in 2002 when he was coming to power. It was supposed to be this zero problems with neighbors policy, and it was very pro-European Union, pro-NATO. So that was in a way to compete with the secular establishment when he was coming to power. When he, and we can talk about these things later if it comes up, but when these secular actors, including the military, were defanged, then Erdogan had a different policy that he furthered not only in the region but beyond. And in addition to that, if we look at the very recent actions, we can see Erdogan being challenged at the domestic front more than ever. If you have followed the mayoral elections in Istanbul and Ankara, cities, major cities that were under AK Party governance for 25 years are right now in the oppositions. And Erdogan's own people started to establish political parties that will go against AK Party in future elections. Add to that, the declining economic situation in Turkey, further declining, I should say. Well, the official rate, they say, is like 12.9, but many economists actually say that the real rate is probably close to something between 20-25%. So he's facing a challenge, a very low Turkish lira, challenging economic situation, internal competitors, not only from the opposition parties, but also from his own party. So this is the time to up the ante and make certain claims. These claims are not just Erdogan's claims, by the way. Like Professor Zampiras made a reference to, I mean, these are historical issues, historical claims. It's not just AK Party's case. But he feels right now that this is the time to assert these claims, both slightly to divert attention from the domestic situation and also to create an international question that majority of the Turks can agree on. And we can talk about this in the coming minutes.
If I can just jump in here. When it comes to President Erdogan, he's now been in power for 18 years. And barring some surprise, he's supposed to be there until 2023. So already that's an indication. You don't have many democratic leaders staying in power for two decades in a row. I see three things happening right now in his transformed policy. Again, Professor Sandel was very correct. The slogan was zero problems with neighbors. Now it's zero neighbors without problems. So that's an issue. I think there are three things happening that worry me personally. One is that following the 2016 coup d'etat, I think that Erdogan has more authoritarian tendencies. He has exhibited more authoritarianism, and that's not stopping right now. The second is, I do think he's aggressive, both in deeds and in rhetoric. And rhetoric, when you're in a crisis situation, does matter. It could make a difference. But the third thing is the one that I worry much the most. And during the Ataturk years and the ones of his successors, you know, a lot of countries had a lot of issues with Turkey, especially Greece and Cyprus. But one thing that was a constant in Turkish foreign policy was a policy of no change in borders. Even when Cyprus was invaded, there was a republic created that was only recognized by one state. It never was incorporated into Turkey. So the previous, let's say, regime had a policy, no change in borders. It now seems to me that in both rhetoric and deeds, Erdogan is playing with the idea of perhaps making changes to the 1923 Lausanne Treaty, which is the treaty governing the borders right now in the region. If he's also revisionist, in addition to being aggressive and more authoritarian, then we got us a problem here. And I think that that makes any kind of diplomatic de-escalation more difficult. And it's why you have several actors, including, we can talk about this, Germany, the United States, trying and lessening tensions right now.
I would like to have a really quick follow-up, if possible. All our great points. Mm-hmm. And I would like to actually bolster one of Professor Zampiris's points. Many AK Party representatives and Erdogan himself actually made references to the Lausanne Treaty and Kemalist actions at the time, saying that these were, they basically ceded the territory that belonged to, should belong to Turkey, to the enemy. So there is this feeling that Erdogan has and the party has that the Kemalist establishment actually got satisfied with so minimum, and that has to be corrected at some point. And even during the zero problems with neighbors policy times, Ahmet Davutoğlu at the time wrote a book on strategic debt that criticized how Turkey did not fulfill its potential in all the areas it has governed at the time. So even during the peaceful times, there was this talk about the desire to find yourself in this strategic space. And we just see the escalation of the actions, of course, since those more peaceful times.
So, I once got to talk to Minister Davutoğlu, and I actually asked him about the zero problems with neighbors. He goes, well, it's a slogan. However, let me say that in his book, Strategic Debt, he says, and this is pretty much a direct quote, that had the Cyprus issue not been there, it should have been invented. So he understood Cyprus as being of extreme strategic importance to Turkey, other than all the historical things that we have alluded to.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's topic, the ongoing crisis in the Eastern Mediterranean, the possibility of conflict, and the impact that natural gas drilling could potentially have on climate change. So Professor Sandal, Professor Zampiris had suggested, I mean, one of the things Turkey has never done is indicated the possibility of annexing the eastern part of the island of Cyprus and recognizing it as an independent state. Now, legally, of course, it's not recognized by any state other than Turkey, but practically, it actually is kind of governed like an independent state. There's a de facto separation of the two and a border that is not recognized, but it's enforced, actually enforced by, you know, UN forces, among others. Could this change? Because I would imagine if Turkey's got drilling interests in areas where the eastern part of Cyprus would be considered the sovereign territory on the basis of, you know, the law of the sea, except that if Turkey were to annex part of that territory, it would create Turkish sovereignty. Is this a possibility, or is that just too much of an agitation? And certainly, you know, other European powers would not sit back and allow the annexation of Eastern Cyprus without some sort of political and possibly military action?
I don't see annexation as a current possibility, frankly. Because, first of all, Turkey doesn't need annexation to make claims. on the sea. Let's also cover some basics. Turkey is not party to United Nations Convention on Law of the Sea. So it has its own conception of what constitutes shelf and what constitutes EEZ, the exclusive economic zone. And it tries to play its game through its own forged alliances, including with, I mean, the situation in Libya obviously is part of that. So I see this as the culmination of some of the actions we have seen in the past by Turkey that starts with buying anti-missile defense systems from Russia. And then we come to going into Syria with US carte blanche almost. So although there were some implications, Turkey and Erdogan has seen that he has the refugee card with 4 million refugees in his control. So he sees that there are no serious ramifications to these actions. I mean, when things were happening with S-400s, everybody was looking at the NATO membership, right? I mean, how is this going to work out with your presence in a military alliance? Did anything happen? Yes, there were some deals that were canceled and stuff, but Turkey is still a NATO member. And Turkey still holds these cards. And that is one of the frustrations right now, that there is no unified voice against Turkey and its actions. So this is all to say, in short, that Turkey already established its own terms and playing with its own terms. So annexation would be dirty. Annexation would be very difficult. And it would not be very welcome with the Cypriots themselves, I would say, no, Turkish Cypriots themselves. So I don't see that. I see many things as possibilities, but not that particular scenario for now.
There are two points I'd like to make here. One is that it's what Douglas suggests is actually true. In the 21st century, there's basically another wall, the remaining wall in Europe. Berlin Wall fell down, but there's a de facto wall between the occupied part of Cyprus and the international recognized part of Cyprus. And that's pretty shocking. Not many people realize this, but this is an occupation with its own wall, essentially, enforced. Professor Sandel actually raises a crucial issue. And the issue is, what kind of clout does the West have over Erdogan and Turkey? If we don't like a specific behavior, what can we do to change it? Short of war, okay? And that is, you know, to the very point of what is happening right now. Let me suggest two or three things that might be of importance. The European Union has actually two tools. The one is membership. It's not happening with Turkey. Everyone understands it. It's a fiction. They pretend to be candidates, and the European Union pretends that maybe they'll join one day. It's not happening. So that's gone. That's not on the table. What the European Union can do is impose sanctions, meaningful sanctions, at a time when the Turkish economy has problems. To get all the European Union countries to agree on that is actually not that easy, but that's the one weapon that the EU has. The US now has PATSA, the Countering American Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, PATSA. So if you really want to be tough with Turkey, again, a nominal maybe, but an ally through NATO, but if there's now a tool that didn't exist back in 74, so Congress can use this to enforce sanctions. Then I think there's a third thing that can happen, which is prevention. And the best way to prevent worse things happening is through a military presence, the Sixth Fleet when it comes to the US. The French are doing it, but obviously they don't compare with US military power. Sending a message that diplomacy is the way to go and not threats of military action. I cannot stress enough how important it is to de-escalate tensions right now. This is the eastern flank of NATO. It's an election year in the United States. Elections are, what, 50 days or so? Very close. So it's easy to lose the ball, so to speak. The situation remains tense. Final point on here. Nobody in Brussels or DC wants to say, I lost Turkey. And that gives Erdogan a lot of clout. At the same time, if he gets a pass, in my opinion, on everything that he does, we will just get a bigger crisis down the road. So at some point, through diplomacy and perhaps through economic sanctions, a framework of what is acceptable and what is not has to be determined, in my view.
In the past, when we've had these conflicts, you know, we had this conflict over Cyprus or tensions between Greece and Turkey or Turkey and its neighbors, the United States has typically played a pretty essential role at trying to de-escalate tensions. And in part because it seemed like the United States was that one actor that could really constrain Turkey in the way that Europeans didn't, because Turkey had really valued that relationship with the U.S., primarily expressed by Turkey's involvement in NATO. There's been a lot of conversation that one of the causes of this tension, this current tension, is that avenue of influence has diminished, whether it's because Turkey cares less about the U.S.'s position, or maybe the U.S. just cares less about exercising this avenue of, you know, of pressure for de-escalation. So sort of two questions, I'll ask them first, both of Nukhet. First is this something that's kind of idiosyncratic to the current administration, to the Trump administration, or is this a general view that the U.S. is less engaged? And then if not the U.S., then who? Is there another actor that might be able to step in that might compel de-escalation?
I will start, and I'm sure Professor Zampiris can follow up and we can discuss. So a couple of things are different when we look at the longer historical timeline. Normally, when I teach, I always tell my students that when it comes to foreign policy, there is not actually much different difference between Republican and Democrat administrations. Trump changed many of our frameworks, starting with NATO, right? I mean, no U.S. president before questioned the usefulness of NATO or the close ties, of course, with Russia. So that there is a slight departure there, and there are different priorities everywhere, every region in the Middle East as well. After a couple of phone calls with Erdogan, of course, Trump and Erdogan had their moments, but there were times when he said, well, we are the same type of people, you know, we understand each other, Trump said. So it is, so you have these interesting leaders, and also when you look at Turkey, Turkey has never been a solid democracy, let's say, but the level of repression right now is quite different from the past. Like right now, there are not many internal domestic circles left to criticize some of these actions, because the way they are presented is this is an existential issue for Turkey and its strategic interests. If you are against these actions, you are a traitor, you are a terrorist, and you might go to jail. And we have many politicians in the jail, journalists in the jail for expressing critical views. So you are looking at a country where you don't have any credible opposition who could question these issues. Yes, there is some opposition still emerging. Trump administration has not been very passionate about NATO or any issues. And it is, I think, playing day by day right now because of the election year. They also don't want to go into big risks. And Erdogan, as Professor Zampiris also brought up, I mean, it is, what are you going to do? So right now there is this slight arrogance. I'm doing this and you piss me off and I'll do something else. And I know that can be here and there some sanctions, but I don't think he believes that European Union or US can counter him. Who can play a constructive role? So right now Germany is trying. And Germany and Turkey has arms deals and very close relations in certain industries. So and Germany actually in the past brought Turkey back from these drilling initiatives. So I can see Germany maybe continuing this role. What we are going to see is Turkey's NAVEX warning is expiring in a couple of days. And if Turkey does not extend that warning, I think we are being cleared for maybe some talks and some cool-headedness. But if Turkey extends that warning and stays where it is, then I don't know how much Germany even can do, given especially the frustrations of France and some other countries that actually want to see some bold action against Turkey.
I have to stress that probably for the first time in three quarters of a century, since the 1940s, really, we're having a crisis in this part of the world with the United States not automatically taking the diplomatic initiative. To me, this is striking. Has not happened since the 1940s. Let me also say that in what are, in my view, the most important issues in the region, in Syria, hundreds of thousands dead, millions displaced, refugees, chemical weapons, Russia has been more important than the United States. In Libya, I would argue that Turkey has been more important than the United States the past few years. And when it comes to the issue of Turkey, the United States has not a clear policy or position throughout the past years. This does not start with Trump. For example, the United States elected to take somewhat of a backseat in Syria during the Obama years, but it was far more pronounced during the Trump administration. Germany took the diplomatic lead, and Germany, on the one hand, has great commercial, important commercial relations with Turkey. There are also several million Turks or people of Turkish descent living, and many of them voting in Turkey. And from a Greek perspective, if Germany's equidistant, it's maddening because you're a member of the European Union, you expect solidarity from other members, not equal equidistant policies, but at the same time, I can see how this could help diplomacy. Germany has no real hard power. On the other hand, France has hard power and is pressuring Turkey as much as it can in the region. So what I'm seeing is because the crisis really with Greece starts at around June, it's Germany that takes the diplomatic lead. Also, the president has the presidency of the European Council, so that is fortuitous in a way. France has a much more active military role pressuring Turkey in the region. And it's only after mid-August that you get President Trump to call the Greek prime minister, the Turkish president, and you have Secretary of State Pompeo going to Cyprus. So my guess is that Germany had the lead, France, it was almost a good cop, bad cop kind of like act, if I can use that analogy. But I'm also seeing the United States belatedly taking further diplomatic action to de-escalate tensions. And there's another question to think about. The East Med is a tinderbox of a region, but it's woefully under-institutionalized. If there's a crisis, there's a probably apocryphal, but Kissinger once said, well, if I want to talk to Europe, whom do I call? If you want to talk to the East Med, who do you call? There's not an institution right there. So, we are academics. This is something we can think about long term. Maybe we need to have a different institutional structure in the region that makes talking not equivalent to appeasement.
When we come back, Turkey's drive for natural gas drilling and pipeline construction is building hostilities in the Eastern Mediterranean. What might stop another conflict between Turkey, Cyprus, and Greece? Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Turkey's aggressive push to drill for oil and natural gas in the Mediterranean is raising the ire of Greece and Cyprus. What does this mean for the region and for climate change mitigation initiatives in Europe? Doug Becker explores.
We've been focused quite a bit on Western influences on Turkey, whether it's Germany, the US, France, etc. But what about Turkey's Eastern neighbors or their Arab neighbors? Because there's at least a potential in, you know, broadly for Turkey's foreign policy. I mean, one of the reasons why Turkey is so important to the US is the way that it straddles between Europe and, you know, in Asia, the Middle East. Is there a potential here where there could be other Arab countries that might have an influence on Turkey's behavior? And would they be interested in de-escalation at all?
I don't see that happening either, because Turkey is pretty well isolated, actually, in the Middle East by Arab countries. One exception, obviously, its special relationship with Qatar. And outside of that relationship, Turkey has tried to associate, especially with the Muslim Brotherhood groups in the region. Some did not well, like we have seen in Egypt. And in Libya, again, those ties are being explored. Although Erdogan tried to cater to the Muslim populations of the Middle East, and I would say, as importantly, to sub-Saharan Africa, where he has been really influential and AK Party has been welcomed in countries like Somalia, the Arab neighbors, not neighbors, the Arab countries in the region have not really welcomed his activism, his discourse. Saudi Arabia, for example, I mean, because of the Muslim Brotherhood ties, I mean, it is, things have been really tentative and tense with Turkey for a long time. And we don't even need to talk about Egypt right now after Morsi and with current Sisi administration. And I would say, if anything, and this goes back to the not changing the borders, Turkey actually deals much better with a country like Iran, where it has this mutual understanding. I mean, there is not much love, but at the same time, this mutual understanding, and we are not going to cater to each other's territories anyways, than with some of the Arab neighbors in the region. And two things, I think, for Turkey in the region: Iran has been the stable, relatively stable neighbor, and Russia is also very important, what Russia does. So, I mean, if you look at the Turkish history, that is where the trauma comes from. Like all these wars started by the Ottomans and won by the Russians. So there is this political culture there still. And Turkey and Russia pretty well dealt with each other in Syria. You know, I mean, here and there with ad hoc agreements. And obviously there were disappointments. But there is that dynamic going on too. And I think it is, it would be naive to discount the role of Russia in both Libya and in the general, on the general Turkish foreign policy.
I think one of the questions you had raised about Eastern Mediterranean governance is there was one area of governance that always seemed to be where de-escalation was expected to occur if it was between Greece and Turkey, and that's NATO. Is this a sign that NATO has really frayed, that NATO's influence in the region has really frayed? So the reason why perhaps we need some form of governance, some institutional setting for these issues, that this is really a sign that at least in this region, it's fair to say NATO has lost quite a bit of its influence.
Well, there are two things I'd like to say addressing your question. One is that NATO is actually trying, and there's some NATO diplomacy going on right now. So it's certainly a framework where discussions can take place and some pressure applied. But there's a structural problem. Both Greece and Turkey have veto power over NATO decisions. So that renders any decision harder. Furthermore, the understanding is and has been that when it comes to NATO, it's the United States that is the big kahuna, that is the key actor. So when the U.S. is slightly less engaged with NATO, that makes NATO as a whole less effective especially when it comes to its members and dealing with its eastern flank. So I would not go so far as to say, oh, this is the end of NATO, but I would stress, if you have a situation where Greece and Turkey are at war, that's very bad for NATO. Let me also actually highlight the following piece of information. In the past few days, we've had United Arab Emirates jets stationed in the Greek island of Crete during the height of the crisis. And that sends, I think, a message about how several Arab countries see what is going on. And this happened right after Pompeo visited UAE. So it's a very interesting dynamic, which I think Professor Sandel described very, very accurately. The one place where Turkey has or seems to have a big influence is with the UN-recognized government of Libya, which has received tremendous support from Erdogan. Erdogan has signed two agreements with this government. The government does not actually control the country, all of the country. And this is actually one place where Russia and Turkey support different actors within. It's very complicated. But Libya has been one place where the current administration is extremely close to Erdogan. The other is Qatar and maybe Azerbaijan. And I think that's it. And I have to stress that relations between Iran and Turkey have gotten closer, not allied, but closer. And I think that is something that has raised some eyebrows in Washington, D.C.
Turkey's more aggressive moves in the drilling for natural gas in the Eastern Mediterranean also is taking place in the context of a European Union that it has at least sought to limit the drilling for fossil fuels in the Mediterranean. Is it the issue that Turkey has chosen to challenge Europe on is, you know, on this issue of the exploration for fossil fuels in the context of the need for global action against climate change? I'd imagine it's isolating Turkey all the more. And does that make this a unique type of challenge? I'll ask Professor Sandel first.
So Turkey has, and I wrote about some of these dynamics and norms in one of my articles a couple of years ago. So Turkey is a very typical, what I call, second generation middle power. And the argument is, I mean, we are not going to play by your rules and you define what climate change is. You guys, you meaning these Western colonial powers, you define what the agreements are, and we are not at the table. And that type of discourse actually has been shared by Brazil and sometimes India and some powerful sub-Saharan African countries like Nigeria. There is definitely, and we see this with all the agreements that Turkey is not part of or is planning to withdraw from. Recently, I'm sure you have noticed the women's rights agreements that Turkey brought up, like withdrawing from, which caused a lot of stir within the country, and rightly so. So Turkey has this desire to detach itself from any legal framework that is shared with these Western and colonial powers, they say. So in that sense, yes, there is this part that some other countries might think that Turkey is not really a fan of international agreements, which also brings in maybe this issue of climate change. So, but I don't think it's the only reason, like leaving Turkey. Turkey plays its own game, yes, because if you bring Turkey onto any agreements, it is likely that there will be some resistance to the terms. But at the same time, I would love to hear Professor Zampiris' insights into that. I am sure those states and those actors have guessed that Turkey would want to be part of something that big going on in Eastern Mediterranean, and you cannot get away with not including Turkey. How could you include it given its current mindset is another question, but you are right, Doug. I mean, it is Turkey is really not sensitive to those pressures, and it does not have a liking for international legal frameworks right now. And it wants to establish its own terms and be recognized for establishing these terms.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. Today's topic, the ongoing crisis in the Eastern Mediterranean and the potential for conflict between Greece, Turkey, and possibly other countries such as Cyprus, Israel, and France. Now, Aristotle, when the Europeans are confronting Turkey on this and calling for, you know, some sort of unified action against Turkey, is climate change the context that we need to do something to stop the drilling, or is it about Cyprus, or is it about the rise of Turkey and the way in which Turkey could potentially upset the balance of power, or is it something else?
There are three things I'd like to say. First of all, the European Union is moving towards renewables. There's no doubt about that. And that is should have a positive impact on climate change or climate crisis, as I prefer to refer to it. However, this has an unintended consequence. We know that in the East Med, there's oil and natural gas. If the move is towards renewables, and if because of COVID and other reasons, prices are falling, then the window to take advantage of these resources is closing. Hence, there's an urgency to move forward. So this is a very interesting dynamic. Secondly, there's one regional organization, the East Med Gas Forum, that was created and has as members Israel and the Palestinian Authority. I can't think of another example. Jordan, Italy, Egypt, Greece, Cyprus. France wants to become a member. U.S. wants to become an observer, but not Turkey. Turkey is invited to become a member, but you understand, I think Professor Sandel said, you know, with threats, not recognizing Cyprus, it's difficult. But there's been some move, and Turkey has not been part of it, but Turkey could be if changes happened in certain, policies and practices. It's not going to happen soon, in my opinion. The third point, which makes this even more complex, is that if you want to take advantage of whatever resources you have, hydrocarbons, and you don't have a century to take care of this, but you have to move forward, you need to do things such as declare and delimit exclusive economic zones. Why? Because companies who want to pour in billions, they want to be legally secure. They want to know, okay, this is fine from a legal point, so I can put in my billions and maybe 10 years from now make some money. Because there are no quick fixes when it comes to energy projects. So suddenly we start coming up with these agreements. Greece signed one with Italy, a partial one with Egypt. The big one was between Libya and Turkey. And here's where it becomes really interesting. If you had a map, you'd see that these are competing agreements. You can't have all of them at the same time. So this is the question, what do you do? Current situation, tension, not good. War, absolutely not an alternative. In my mind, there are only two ways you can deal with such competing claims when it comes to continental shelf or exclusive economic zones. The other half states negotiate, or you have to go to the International Court at The Hague. One of the two. I don't even want to think about any other scenario. So this is what we should really try to move forward. Discussion, not threats, not war, but negotiations, diplomacy, perhaps international adjudication. That's fine also.
As we think about, you know, the conclusion of this conversation, at least, Professor Sandel, first to you, we've painted a pretty grim picture of the possibility of restraining Turkish behavior, restraining Turkish foreign policy. And I know that the European press in particular has become rather alarmist at these moves. There's clearly a possibility for conflict. What's the likelihood of conflict? If conflict did emerge, what kind of forms would it take? We could certainly imagine a war, but that would be an absolute nightmare scenario. I imagine conflict could take a lot of different forms other than just war.
That's correct. That's a really good point. And I think we already have the conflict part. What we don't want is war. And what we don't want is this to escalate. And I don't think any party here actually wants war. They cannot afford it. They know it. Turkey doesn't want war. Greece doesn't want war. The thing that everybody is afraid of is wars don't usually sometimes start because people don't want wars or want wars. You know, it is just one misunderstanding. One little action, one little incident can bring parties to a really undesired scenario. So in that sense, I'm hoping to observe is that recognition of these really sensitive balance that has a lot of, as both I and Professor Zampiris mentioned throughout this conversation, this is a very big issue with a long history. And hopefully parties will be aware of this and keep their cool heads and be ready for certain agreements. There can be, again, we don't have time for this, but there can be 10, 15 scenarios one could think of, certain concessions here and there or certain issues. So I am hoping that, and Turkey said that it is open to the talks and negotiations or whatever those mean, but it's open to talks. So, and these talks hopefully will either delay this situation a little bit because nobody is establishing this pipeline tomorrow. So I'm hoping that this is a very long-term and expensive project and it will take a lot of steps. So I'm really hoping that parties will step back, even if for a limited time, revise the options, see the possibilities. Unfortunately, I do not see like a problemless future given the Erdogan policies recently. But I'm optimistic that they can step back from this brink with the right negotiations, right agreements, right conversations, and hopefully, again, postpone this to a different time.
And Professor Zampiris, these types of situations can open the door to new solutions. You had suggested the potential, the need for new forms of governance. Is there a potential for a positive outcome where the Eastern Mediterranean, which has been this kind of powder keg, as you've described, and getting closer and closer to, you know, to possibly blowing up, could be de-escalated to such a degree where we may come out of this crisis on the other side with a much more stable region than we currently have?
I think it's possible. I think it was Winston Churchill who said, Jaja is always better than war. So I actually believe in talking and in diplomacy. The thing is, you can do diplomacy on the basis of threats. So the first thing to do is de-escalate both rhetoric and the military aspects of this crisis. They have to go together. You can have threats and at the same time ask for the military to go back to their to their bases. But let me give you an example of how this region could be better. Professor Sindel actually alluded to the so-called East Med natural gas pipeline. I don't know if it's going to happen. It may or may not. It's a challenging long-term project that's going to link, if it happens, Israel, Cyprus, Greece, and eventually it's going to go to Italy. But here's a big lesson. We often hear pipelines for peace. We'll build a pipeline and peace will come. But in reality, it's the other way that the world works. You improve political relations. And this is an example where Greece, Cyprus, and Israel improved their relations after 60 years. And once you have better political relations, a stable political framework, then you can start thinking big, ambitiously, and thinking of projects that will unite the region and link it really to Europe. So the emphasis ought to be for now to de-escalate the rhetoric, get rid of the threats, make sure that the military goes back, and then give diplomacy a chance. But the region has seen examples where after many decades, actors did come together, and that actually presents the opportunity of how the natural resources can help cooperation and not contribute to turbulence and confrontation.
So this conflict certainly has been brewing, as we demonstrated. The Cyprus conflict and the conflict between Greece and Turkey has been out there, but the recent threats in the region being driven by an aggressive Turkish foreign policy and a lack of an institutional setting, as well as seemingly a lack of an ability for parties that might compel de-escalation, seems to be driving the potential for this conflict. But the good news is, it seems like we as a panel agree that none of the actors want war. We certainly hope we don't stumble into the war. And the possibility that the threats could lead to a more stable region certainly can leave us with at least some hope that this is not going to be the next powder keg, not the next area of conflict. Though I would like to point out that the Eastern Mediterranean and Balkans region does not have a good historic track record as far as conflict resolution and avoiding conflict from external powers. So with that, I'd like to thank our guests. We've discussed the conflict in the Eastern Mediterranean, and explicitly the conflict between Greece, Turkey, Cyprus, and issues of drilling. Our guests have been Nuket Sendal, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Ohio University. She's the author of Religious Leaders and Conflict Transformation, and Aristotle Zamparis, Professor of International Relations and the Director of the MSc Program in Energy, Strategy, Law, and Economics at the University of Piraeus. And he's the President of the Council for Foreign Relations of Greece. He is the author of Greece, European Political Cooperation, and the Macedonian Question. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.